Hey there, welcome to Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris. Dr. Craig and I have been having a good time listening to this Real Atheology podcast. Ben and Justin do a good job bringing on some good guests, and we're kind of on a roll. We've been listening to some of these interviews that they've done on this podcast, and we're going to interact with another one today. Dr. Craig responds to an interview with Dr. Evan Fales, a philosopher today that many of you may be familiar with. And by the way, as we get started, I want to remind you again, go to reasonablefaith.org. A lot going on at the website, some new things. You can always support our ministry there at reasonablefaith.org. Definitely stop by, bookmark it, go there often. Okay? And here's the first excerpt from this interview with Dr. Evan Fales.
In your article in the Black Bull Companion to the Problem of Evil a few years back, you build an argument around an interesting concept that you call a perfect creature.
Right.
So what is a perfect creature?
This is, in a way, just a natural outcome of pushing this line of thought.
Pushing it further and further.
Yeah. Further and thinking, well, you know, just how good could God make creatures, assuming that he wanted to maximize value in the universe, mm-hmm. along these lines. And it struck me that it is really hard to find any sort of argument that forecloses on the possibility that God could create beings that are just exactly like him, except for one feature, which is that, of course, trivially, they are created creatures, whereas God is uncreated. But otherwise, they would be just like identical twins, mm-hmm. to God. And wouldn't that be a great world? These are creatures that would be as free as God is. And now, by the way, I mean, this is a matter of some controversy among Christian philosophers and theologians. You know, is God free or isn't he? I personally happen to have views about freedom of the will, which are libertarian, but along which, or a consequence of which are that God is maximally free. And so perfect creatures would be maximally free as well. However, like God, they would necessarily only will and do the very best.
So God is essentially morally perfect, but he's morally free in the sense that he's not held down by any kind of irrational desires or any kind of dispositions.
Yeah, and
in
fact,
sense.
I mean, I situate myself in a long tradition that tries most fundamentally to understand freedom of the will as a matter of having the capacity to exercise reason,
okay,
rational choice. In fact, for me, the act of freely deciding just is the act of rationally deliberating.
Okay.
And God is maximal in his ability to do that. He has maximum information. He has maximum power when it comes to seeing consequences, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. And so he's maximally free.
I suspect, Kevin, that the notion of a perfect creature is an oxymoron, that such a thing is metaphysically impossible, that perfection is an attribute of God alone, who is the greatest conceivable being. So I don't think it's possible, probably, that God could create another being exactly like him, except it would be created. I think a being that is morally perfect would be God himself. Moreover, did you notice that he says that God's perfect freedom is the capacity to exercise reason. So in order to be perfectly free like God, we would have to have perfect rationality. And that, again, I think is probably incompatible with creaturehood. So I suspect that the hypothesis that Fales is entertaining here is simply a fantasy. And I see no reason to think that there could be such a thing as a creature who has perfect freedom and perfect goodness.
Okay. Here's the second segment.
The plenum objection is the worrisome one. And the plenum objection simply goes like this. Well, for all you know, Evan Fales, God did create perfect creatures. And, you know, bully for him. I mean, That was a good thing to do. But why should he stop with perfect creatures? After all, there might be tons of other types of beings which are such that they're worthy of existence and such that the world would be have more value in it, right, if they did exist. Plus, you have the added benefit of variety.
Right.
I mean, a perfect creature world is, after all, a little bit dull. So why wouldn't God have created other things, including even such woebegone creatures as ourselves, in addition to the perfect creatures? Why wouldn't he have created a kind of plenum of worthwhile existence? And I don't have a decisive argument against that view, but I do have reasonably strong intuitions that it would be ill-advised for God to do that, and that it wouldn't be an improvement. First of all, because when it comes to amount of value, each of the perfect creatures has an infinite amount of value, but my value is only finite. You add a finite bit to an infinite bit, what do you get?
It's kind of trivial.
Now, that may be too simple. I mean, maybe I have a kind of value that a perfect creature doesn't have. It's not commensurable with the value of a perfect creature. Sure. Even if there are some uniquely worthwhile goods that could only be brought about by creatures such as we, there's an awfully high price to pay for that. And God would have known that if he has foreknowledge. Why would he do that? I mean, why would he? It may even be true that in some ways there's more value in the world, more net value in the world, if he creates us than if he doesn't. But you can't say, well, it's because he wants creatures that are free, because perfect creatures are free.
Right.
Well, he wants company and things to worship him because the perfect creatures can do that.
Well, I've already said that I don't think that God could create perfect creatures. But here Fayol says, well, maybe he did, but he also created some imperfect creatures as well. And Fayol doesn't have a knockdown argument against this. He just says, well, it would be ill-advised on God's part. Well, of course, nobody is turning to Fayol for advice to God about what he ought to do. But I think, for example, of the value of redemption. Alvin Plantinga has speculated that maybe a world in which the great self-sacrificial redemption wrought by Christ occurs is a world that is actually more valuable and greater than a world in which sin never occurs. And I think that's not at all implausible. God's redemptive love is more manifestly shown in a world of imperfect creatures in which he redeems them by this act of self-giving sacrifice than in a world of these supposedly perfect creatures who have no need of redemption and forgiveness. So here I think we are just simply lost in speculation and conjecture. We've really left any kind of, I think, strong plausibility arguments on Fayol's part.
In your opinion, what do you think is the most promising or interesting, I guess take your pick, argument in the theist's toolbox?
I do think that the development of sophisticated fine-tuning arguments by Robin Collins and some others. And, you know, I mean, I'm open to the possibility that such arguments can be successful. My main response to Robin is, look, we're talking here about the results of particle physics and cosmology, which are and have been in a state of considerable flux for some time now, you know, 50, 60, 70 years. And what people think now and what they will think 10 years from now are quite likely to be rather different stories, perhaps even fairly fundamentally different stories. We don't know. And what you're doing is to some extent, holding your argument hostage to ignorance, our ultimate ignorance about, you know, fuss and feathers over something that may be changing.
It's interesting how many atheists are impressed with the fine-tuning argument. That is to say that this universe appears against all probability to have been fine-tuned for the existence of conscious, embodied life in the universe. And he's certainly right in saying that Robin Collins is probably the premier defender of this argument today. But Fayol's response to this, our listeners need to understand, is really desperate. The idea that fine-tuning is based upon physics that is highly in flux and may be overturned is simply inaccurate. The cases of fine-tuning that physics continues to discover are so numerous and so various that the idea that they're all going to vanish by some advance in a future physics is highly implausible. So I think that the theist who holds to intelligent design as the best explanation of fine-tuning is basing his argument on pretty solid scientific foundations, and the atheist who would avert the argument by holding out hope that somehow the fine-tuning is going to evaporate is really adopting a desperate hypothesis that goes strongly against the evidence.
Okay. Here's the final segment. Listen to what he says about the renaissance of Christian philosophy.
So setting aside, specific arguments for and against theism, in your opinion, what do you think are some of the more interesting or surprising, broad developments in philosophy of religion since the kind of renaissance of the 1960s?
It's really a phenomenon. In fact, with the demise of positivism, I anticipated that this something like this would happen, that Christian philosophy would no longer be considered professionally disreputable, and it would start to emerge, and it certainly has.
Well, Fayol's expectations have been met, haven't they?
Yes.
And if I might answer the interviewer's questions, I think one of the most fruitful areas of Christian philosophy over the last several decades has been an analysis of the concept of God. A popular atheistic argument back in the 60s and early 70s was that the very concept of God is incoherent, and that therefore no argument or evidence for God could succeed because no amount of evidence could establish the existence of a being which is incoherent. And this has led to just an avalanche of philosophical work on the concept of God. And this has been the area of philosophy which I have dedicated myself professionally. I think most of our listeners probably know of my work through the defense of theistic arguments because they're often featured in the public debates that I engage in. But actually, those haven't been my main interest in philosophy. My main interest has been in what's called the coherence of theism. And so I spent 7 years, for example, studying God's omniscience and explicating the compatibility of divine foreknowledge and human freedom, and also defending the doctrine of middle knowledge. I then turned to the subject of divine eternity and explored in considerable depth for a period of 12 years the relationship between God and time. And this led to a rich interdisciplinary study of God, relativity theory, time as it plays a role in various theories of physics, as well as philosophy of time, and resulted in 6 books that came out of that study. And then most recently, I've completed a study that lasted over 12 years on divine aseity, which concerns God's relationship to abstract objects and how the theist can meet the challenge of Platonism, which is the view that there are necessary, eternal, self-existent objects apart from God. And I try to show various ways in which the theist can meet that challenge successfully. So this has been, I think, one of the most fruitful and interesting areas of Christian philosophy, which puts one very much in dialogue with other fields of philosophy. philosophy. To just give one more example, I'm currently studying the doctrine of the atonement. And in reflecting philosophically on the doctrine of the atonement, this has taken me into another area of philosophy in which I had not worked before, and that's philosophy of law. It is in the philosophy of law that the theory of punishment, for example, has been most developed by philosophers. And so in order to understand the atonement, you need to understand something about the theory of punishment, both the definition of punishment and the justification of punishment. And so this has been an unexpectedly rich study. Anthony Kenney, the Oxford philosopher, once remarked to me that the reason he found philosophy of religion so interesting is that it's like the hub of a wheel from which spokes go out and touch every other area of philosophy. And I find that image so apt. Theism at the hub, at the center of the wheel, and then these spokes relating to all of these other disciplines of philosophy, philosophy of time, philosophy of mathematics, logic, philosophy of language, and so on and so forth. It's really been a very gratifying experience for me to study the concept of God over these years.